Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. I have an extraordinary guest today from a part of the world that is near and dear to my heart because it has so many similarities and overlaps to my part of subtropical Australia. Today, I have Gus Le Breton from Zimbabwe, who is a ethnobotanist, a plant finder, an explorer, and has an amazing YouTube channel where I first found his work. And today we're going to talk about all the amazing botanical biodiversity in the southern end of Africa that he has come to know and love during his life, and its potential for further co-evolution with humanity. So to get us started, Gus, do you want to tell us a bit about who you are and how you reached this point in your life?
Yes, thanks, Shane. Very nice to be on your podcast. Really appreciate it. As you said, I'm an ethnobotanist in Zimbabwe. I've been working for the last 30 years on commercialization of indigenous plants. And the background to that was I started out as a conservationist, and I was working with rural communities in Zimbabwe looking at ways to promote conservation of indigenous trees and indigenous plants. And I saw a direct correlation between the commercial use of indigenous plants and their protection and conservation. Basically, conservation of an indigenous plant for a rural farmer is an economic land use decision. They can either conserve a plant because it's going to generate them income, or they'll replace it with something else that is going to generate income. And the something else, in our case, is usually an exotic rather than a native cash crop or food crop. And the staple diet in Zimbabwe and the staple crop for smallholder farmers is maize. Maize, of course, comes from Central America, not from Africa. Isn't really suited to our climate. It does well here under certain conditions, but our climate is very variable. And when the conditions aren't right, it doesn't work at all. And I was just, you know, seeing this lamentable or actually tragic situation where people were removing indigenous vegetation that has spent tens of thousands of years evolving to be in exactly the right place in exactly the right time, and then replacing it with a crop that comes from halfway across the world, and then planting it, and then looking at it when it, surprise, surprise, dies because the rains failed, and wondering, you know, what went wrong, and just thinking, well, it's just the problem for them is that there is no commercial opportunity from indigenous plants because there are no products, marketable products, and there's no, I mean, these are plants that, of course, have a very long history of traditional use, but there's no commercial opportunities around them. So that's when I started looking at developing the commercial potential of indigenous plants as alternatives to these exotic cash crops, so that it became a rational economic decision for a smallholder farmer to make to actually conserve indigenous plants in situ rather than replace them with an exotic cash crop. So yeah, that's the background. And I've been doing that in a sort of non-profit research way, but also in a for-profit business way. So I'm involved in quite a number of different business ventures around the commercialization of indigenous plants. I used to run an association called Phytotrade Africa, which was promoting trade in indigenous plant products from Southern Africa into the rest of the world. And I'm also involved in the research side with a research organization in Zimbabwe called Bioinnovation Zimbabwe that is specifically researching indigenous plants for their commercial potential use.
Now, a place to start to flip things around from what we first planned, maybe we can talk about examples of local plants that have already gone through a relatively successful commercial transition, because I think there's a couple of them that stand out already. Do you have any that come to mind?
I certainly have plenty that come to mind. I mean, the one that is perhaps the most well-documented and most well-known and which I've been involved with from the very beginning is baobabs. Adansonia digitata, which is the African baobab, there are 8 different species of baobab altogether around the world, 7 of them in Madagascar, one in Australia, and one of the seven that's in Madagascar is also in mainland Africa. And that's the one that I've been working with, which is the Digitata. They're all at Ansonia. So the baobab is, it's a tree that's, it's very well known. It's found all across dry land Africa mostly. An incredibly hardy and resilient species that survives in climatic conditions that not many other plants can survive. And it's basically a succulent. So it's incredibly good at drawing moisture and conserving moisture from very dry soils.
And if people don't have
And
a picture in their mind, these are the bottle trees that have these huge swollen
exactly.
bases.
It's a big fat tree. It's called the upside down tree because the story is that they were thrown down from the heavens and landed upside down, and they planted with their roots in the air. And yeah, man, it's a very, very memorable tree. If you've ever seen one, you certainly never forget it. And they produce a fruit. The fruit is quite large. It's kind of the size of a can go to the size of a small kind of rugby ball, soccer ball, and with a hard shell like a coconut. And inside there's a dry, powdery, white powdery substance, which is the fruit pulp and seeds, and lots of seeds. And that dried fruit pulp is, or dry, it's naturally dry, that's how it comes, it's full of nutrients. It's very, very healthy, and it's delicious, and it's traditionally consumed across Africa. But although it had been traditionally consumed, there was never any commercial use. So when I started looking at it in Zimbabwe in the mid-1990s, at that time I was running a non-profit organization working with rural communities, we started to look at, potentially developing baobab as a commercial crop. And then we ran into the problem that locally there was a kind of a bit of a stigma at that time against indigenous plant products, because most Zimbabweans felt that this was something that they had consumed in their childhood free, because the trees were just there and they picked up the fruit off the ground and they just eaten them. And it wasn't something that, as they grew up and they kind of climbed the economic ladder, it wasn't something that they wanted to be consuming in future, because, they're aspirational and they want to be improving. They want to be eating modern kind of Western convenience foods, not this traditional food that their grandparents used to eat. So we couldn't sell it in Zimbabwe. There was no domestic market. So we started looking at the international export markets, but then we ran into a regulatory hurdle, which was that the international regulators said, well, prove to us that this is safe. And we said, but I mean, millions of Africans eat it every year safely. There's never, ever, ever been any record of anyone, getting sick from eating baobab, let alone dying from it. And they said, yeah, no, that doesn't matter. We still need you to actually prove it. And to prove it cost us $500,000 to prove that something that we knew was safe was in fact safe. So yeah, that was a long process, and that took us 4 years in the early 2000s, and finally got through in 2008 when we got it approved for sale in the European Union through a process called the Novel Foods Regulations. And then we got it approved in the US and Canada and other parts of the world. And finally, yeah, I mean, it has now developed and it's now well known. There are many companies or food companies around the world that have products incorporating baobab powder in foods or beverages. And yeah, I mean, it's a big success story. I actually am involved with, well, I'm the chairman of an association of baobab producers across Africa called the African Baobab Alliance. And we've got about 70 members now. So 70 companies that are involved in one way or another in the production, processing, and export of baobab. And it's tens of thousands of rural harvesters that are involved in the supply chain. And it is a big success story
Yeah,
now.
that's
But it took a lot
amazing.
of work and a lot of time.
Is baobab used for anything other than the fruit pulp?
Yes, every single part of the fruit is used. So the seed is used to make an oil. So it doesn't have a lot of oil in it. I mean, if you took a sort of conventional, traditional oil seed, like, I don't know, like castor oil or something, you'd probably be looking at about 40% of the mass of the seed comes out as oil. And the baobab, you're looking at about 4%. So it's not a high yield oil, but nevertheless, there is oil in there, and it's a very high quality oil, which is used in the cosmetics industry. I actually use it every day. I've got baobab oil on my skin right now. I put it on after shaving. I wet shave, and after I've shaved, I just use a bit of splash of the oil as a moisturizer. It's incredible. And there's growing demand for it and interest in it in the cosmetics industry. And
Do you think there's any potential for hybridizing the original species to come up with new domestic forms?
I think there's huge potential. I'm a little bit wary of plant breeding rights relating to a sort of a native ingredient from Africa, and not wanting to kind of
Patent, yeah.
basically, yeah, and subvert, Africa's sovereign rights over its own genetic resources. But at the same time, yeah, I mean, obviously there is huge opportunities, and there's no doubt that we haven't even begun to explore it. And I'd say the same with almost all the African indigenous
Yeah.
species. It's
It's
just
early days.
extraordinary how systematically we've ignored and overlooked the opportunities from African plants. And at the same time, what a great opportunity that is for the
Yeah.
future. Because if I mean, if you think about it, I don't know. I mean, just take well, let's take the USA, for example. Let's look at the indigenous plants in the USA. I'm gonna imagine that there are very few plants there that haven't been explored at some level or another for their, long-term commercial potential. And what, 80%, 90% of them? So you've got, if you're looking at the ones that you've still left to explore, maybe there's 10%, maybe 20%, I doubt. But in Africa, it's the other way around. We've probably explored maybe 5% of our plants. 95% of the plants in Africa haven't even looked at yet.
You
So
might
yeah, it's very, very exciting.
you might want to look at the Open Source Seed Initiative, which is a movement for like blocking patenting of plant breeding rights. And there's also models of community-based crop breeding where everyone is involved in the process rather than one lab trying to make everything perfect and then rolling out clones. Particularly for slow-growing trees like treecrops, like baobab, distributing that process and coming up with locally adapted populations because conditions are so variable, that I think there's a lot of potential there.
For sure, absolutely.
It makes me want to move to that lovely red semi-arid coast of Australia where our little patch of baobabs grow. And you were saying they've recently figured out how those trees got there because they're very closely related to the plants in Africa and Madagascar, and nobody quite knew how they got there. There was rumors of people sailing and maybe taking them.
So, I mean, Madagascar is fascinating. I've literally just come back from Madagascar, so it's very fresh on my mind.
I'm so
It's the
jealous.
most
I'm so
fascinating.
jealous.
What a country. Wow. Madagascar split off from mainland Africa 140 million years ago. So, nothing that has evolved and that is around in Madagascar now, nothing living was in any way related to anything that was living in Africa at that time. It's all evolved independently. And there's this weird thing where there's six baobab species on Madagascar, and there's the one in Africa, and there's one in Australia. And it was kind of assumed that they must have come from Africa and then gone to Madagascar and then somehow gone. But in fact, genetic studies recently have just concluded that it's the other way around. They actually started in Madagascar, then went over to Africa, and then off to Australia. And the really interesting thing in Africa is that you look at the distribution pattern of baobabs across Africa, and it's very, very, very closely aligned to patterns of human settlement. And there's absolutely no doubt in my mind. I mean, baobabs long predate Homo sapiens,
Yeah.
and in hominids altogether. I mean, baobabs have probably been around in mainland Africa for about 15 million years, which is way longer than any of us have. But certainly their distribution patterns are very closely aligned to humans, and humans and our ancestors consumed them and spread them across Africa, coming from the East Coast, where they must have arrived, probably floating on bits of vegetation from Madagascar, and then they've been spread all over. So, yeah, I mean, really fascinating. It is
Are they,
fascinating. And then probably the same thing to Australia as well. So.
are they another example of a plant that co-evolved with megafauna, and the megafauna are gone now, and humans have stepped into that role of helping the trees reproduce because so many crops fit that mold?
Yeah, I think that's highly likely. I would say that was highly likely. Yeah.
So tell me about another plant from your part of the world that really excites you.
Well, I have another plant that whose journey has almost got to the same point as baobab, is marula. And marula is we took it marula is interesting. We took a different strategy with marula. So we started working with marula and baobab at about the same time. Now, marula is a juicy fruit. Baobab is a dry fruit. And juicy fruit introduces a different set of challenges, particularly around the processing, because you need to refrigerate the fruit, otherwise they go rotten very quickly.
Where people might
So,
have heard of marula is the liqueur amarula, which is made from it.
yes.
Yes.
So
And
amarula is a proudly South African product. It's actually a cream liqueur
yeah.
that is similar to sort of Baileys Irish Cream, and they incorporate a bit of spirit that's distilled from the marula fruit. Yeah. So
Oh, it's
marula is a fruit that's found, yeah, again, over a lot of Africa. It's a juicy fruit, kind of similar to a plum with a stone in the middle of it.
It's related to mango, isn't it? It's the same family as mango.
Yeah, it's Anacardiaceae. Yeah, it's in the mango family. Yeah, yeah. And it's very tasty. It's very culturally important in the areas where it grows because, again, it grows in very dry areas. And then you've got this kind of really anomalous, beautiful, juicy fruit that at times is so dense on the tree. I mean, there are examples of trees that are producing 400 or 500 kilos, one tree of fruit in a year in the wild. It's not with selective breeding or anything. This is just in nature. I mean, it's extraordinary. So, yeah, and I mean, for example, in Swaziland and in Namibia and in other parts of Africa, there are huge, and the north of South Africa, there are huge festivals around marula season when the marula fruit drop around sort of halfway through the rainy season. It's a time for celebration and partying. The fruits are used to make alcoholic beverages, non-alcoholic beverages. The fruit are just eaten fresh. And then also the seeds are used to make an oil. The oil is both used as a food oil, but also as a cosmetic oil. So to go back to the commercialization path of marula, at the same time that a group of us in Southern Africa were working on developing baobab as a commercial product, we were also working on marula as a commercial product, again through this association which I co-founded and ran for quite a while, called Phytotrade Africa. So we decided with baobab having taken the food ingredient route, which required us to tick all of these regulatory boxes, we decided with marula to go the cosmetic ingredient route and to focus on the oil, which has much lower regulatory hurdles. And the cosmetic oil is really remarkable, and has properties that made it very exceptional. We already had interest from at that stage from the body shop. So, we had a commercial market opportunity for it. So we developed it as a cosmetic ingredient and have sort of de-emphasized the opportunities around the fruit. Given also the additional, as I mentioned, cold storage requirements and just a lot more sophisticated post-harvest handling and processing than the baobab fruit, which is a dry, naturally dry and very stable fruit. So we focused on the oil. The oil has been developed and is now well known in the cosmetics industry as an anti-aging ingredient. It's one of the most potent natural antioxidant oils on the planet. So it's really excellent range of commercial uses around anti-aging and protection of skin and so on. And then now we're starting to look at the potential both for marula oil as a food oil, as a sort of alternative to olive oil, and then also the nuts as an edible nut, and then also the fruit as a juicy fruit, and the juice or the puree or whatever. All of these things we are now exploring. We've got some novel foods applications in around marula that are currently being processed by the European Food Safety Authority. And we hope that we will be able to bring marula through marula juice, marula pulp, marula oil as a food oil through into the food and beverage industry within the next couple of years, which is really exciting because this is a tree. So baobab, the one thing about baobab is it's a very slow growing tree. And you're not going to be seeing any sort of baobab plantations in any time soon. Marula, on the other hand, is quite a quick growing tree, and you could certainly incorporate it into a sort of mixed agroforestry system with, I think, really exciting potential. So we are hoping that that's all going to come true within the next few years.
You might be able to tell me a bit about both of those tree crops. What are the considerations when you're taking a predominantly wild or spontaneous range of diversity, and then you want to sample that to start producing strains for more deliberate planting? I mean, the boundaries there are probably fuzzier in Africa because there's such a long history of people interacting with these species. But for bringing it into the 21st century, like what strategies did you use to like deal with that huge genetic resource that's right on your doorstep?
Well, we have barely begun in that level because for us, the first priority is to determine, is there a market for this product? Can we create a market for the product? There's no ready market for baobab. And any person that is buying baobab is a result of a lot, and I do mean a lot of hard work by a group of people over the last 2 decades to create, because no one had even heard of baobab. No one has heard of marula either. So the fact that people are buying it now is because we've really been pushing it, pushing it, pushing it, pushing it. But there was no point in getting in on the kind of crop breeding side before, with the production side, basically, before we'd established the demand.
That makes
So
perfect
now
sense,
that
yeah.
we have created the demand, or we are in the process of successfully creating the demand, now we're going to get to the point where we're going to start looking at the production and the crop breeding side, which is really exciting and fun. But you have to, you've got to put the horse first and then the cart, and not the other way around. And you've been focusing really on the horse and getting that horse up and running. And then the thing is, farmers are small-scale farmers actually are incredibly innovative given the right sets of conditions. I feel that you will see a lot of innovation from small-scale farmers around selective breeding in the next few years for some of these, once we've created the demand, once there's a clear economic rationale for them to start looking at ways to improve this crop, they will do it. We won't even need to. We'll just watch them
Let them
and
do
it'll
it.
happen.
Well, I mean, tree crop
Yeah,
breeding
totally.
is it's a multi-generational whole community activity. It's not like an annual crop where you can just have one person do it in one field if they're really determined. Tree crop breeding
Yeah.
doesn't work like that. It's a much bigger challenge that you're taking on.
Yeah, and I mean, we are so one of the things we're trying to do now with baobab, which is interesting. So, I mean, think of a well-developed commercial tree crop fruit. Let's say the apple. and think of how many thousands of varieties of apples there are, and it's all the same species. Now we've got Adansonia digitata, and it's grown all over Africa, and we are presenting it to the market as one single product. But in reality, if it grows on a soil in Senegal, where you've got a westerly offshore sea breeze that's bringing in all kinds of whatever, nutrients, blah, blah, blah. And then it's growing in landlocked Zimbabwe, which is 5,000, 7,000 kilometers away with totally different soils. Surely it's going to be different. It can't be exactly the same. So this is something we haven't even begun to scratch the surface. We got a project as the African Baobab Alliance ongoing at the moment, where we are collecting samples from different parts of Africa and trying to at least identify the basic kind of organoleptic differences. Does it taste different? Does it smell different? Does it look different? I mean, let alone the phytochemical and all the rest of it. And it's a long process. I mean, this is going to take us time. And I mean, eventually, we would love to have terroir for baobab as the same as there is for any other product. Yeah, this one comes from a little area in the highlands of eastern wherever, and it's got a particular flavor that makes it very desirable, and there's only produced 5 tons a year, so it's a very small harvest. And I mean, that's normal. That's what we would expect and we want to see. But yeah, we're at the beginning.
I
We're
mean,
at the
if
beginning.
anything, a too narrow a breeding project could actually wipe away, like, if there was one hybrid that like produced 10 times more than the wild species, it could actually displace them if it was used carelessly. So you do need to
Yeah,
balance.
you are so right. Yeah.
Now, are there any crops from your area with a faster life cycle that have stood out to you? Because it's not all tree crops, even though I'm fascinated with tree crops too.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, a few other ones that I've been working on. One that I know you've also come across is the Bambara nut. So, the Bambara nut, which we call here in Zimbabwe, we call it the Nemo bean, sometimes called the Bambara groundnut. I mean, it's got many different names, the round nut. It's a bean, and has been traditionally grown across Africa as a leguminous fruit crop. It is not approved for sale outside of Africa. So legally, you cannot sell it in the European Union. It hasn't gone through the European Novel Foods approval. We do have an application in at the moment. So we are hoping.
Is
It's
it
completely delicious.
mostly used as a dry bean, or is it also for fresh produce?
It's used as both. It's used as both. Obviously, you can preserve it, and as a dry bean, keeps for a really long time. So, I mean, there's lots of advantages to that, but it's absolutely delicious, fresh. And yeah,
And it's called
so you
groundnut
can
because
probably hear.
it's like peanut, right? It burrows its pods into the soil.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's very similar in many ways, and it's also got the shell similar to the peanut. Peanut has a sort of double shell, and a Bambara nut is a single one. It's a little bit bigger than a peanut, but yeah, it's really very similar in many ways. Well, not flavor.
But it's
So
more
it's quite
closely
different.
related to like mung beans and cowpeas. It's a vigna.
Cowpea. So it's Vigna. Yes, exactly. It's in the same genus. Yeah, no, it's a fantastic. So I mean, it's used as a fresh bean. It's also used the flour is then fermented. I mean, any of the ways that you use any other bean, think of soya, for example. Think of all the things that we do with soya. Well, all of those things you can also do with a Bambara nut, and the Bambara nut grows in the same places. Now, here in Zimbabwe, soya is widely grown as a food crop and also for livestock. And I mean, soya is pretty intensive in terms of production. production and the agrochemicals that are used with it and the pests that are used, the pest control. And then the bambara nut grows and you don't need to do anything. Like you just plant it, you do a bit of weeding, and this thing just grows. And it's delicious. And we on an international market can never compete. Zimbabwe, a small scale farmer in Zimbabwe, a landlocked country in the middle of Southern Africa, how can they ever compete on a global market for soya with large scale commercial producers in Brazil or the US or wherever else? Like, no chance. But guess what? They don't produce bambara nut there, and we do. And they'll probably never produce bambara nut because they'll just think, you know what, we can't get the same yields with bambara nut as we can get with our GM soya, whatever. Okay, that's fine. But the thing is with the bambara nut is the small scale farmer here doesn't have to use any agrochemicals. They don't have to. So ecologically, this bambara nut, when it's produced, is much, much, much more sustainable and much, much, much more environmentally friendly than a soybean can ever be. So yeah, I mean, it's really.
Are small scale farmers in your part of the world waking up to the trap that comes with spending all of this money up front on inputs and chemicals and machinery, and then the crop can fail and leave you in ruins? That there's a different strategy to take with the business of farming to
I mean, it's really hard to overcome years and years and years of very successful and very effective sort of colonial era agricultural extension that promoted these crops and have just like incorporated them into people's psyche. I mean, most for I'm talking a lot about Zimbabweans, but when I say Zimbabwe, that's because it's my country. But I mean, it's very, very emblematic of pretty much the whole of Africa. So most Zimbabweans will tell you that their staple food, which is a maize meal porridge, is their traditional food. But of course, it's not their traditional food because 200 years ago there wasn't any maize here. Maize was brought by the colonial as a kind of quick, easy solution to feed the masses. But it wasn't the traditional food at all. Traditionally, in this part of the world, people ate rice and African rice, and they ate millet and they ate sorghum. Those were their grains. And of course, they had a very diverse diet as well. It was a lot of different things in the diet according to the season. But people have been brainwashed to think that this is actually their traditional food. And in the same way, they are still persisting often in thinking that, you know, this is what I have to grow and this is how I have to grow it. Even though last year and the year before and the year before we had drought and didn't harvest anything. So yes, people are waking up and people are coming to terms with the fact that things in the future will need to be done differently from the way they've been done in the past. But it is hard. It is hard. And the thing is, a lot of it is also, it's about the market conditions because at the end of the day, the consumers have decided that the super refined maize meal is preferable, which is white, pearly white, is preferable to the kind of slightly shitty brown color of the millet porridge. And I mean, that's pure cultural brainwashing. Honestly, that's brainwashing. And I remember going to the US 30 years ago and seeing adverts for a bread called Wonder Bread. And Wonder Bread was called Wonder Bread because it remained fresh for about a month because it was so full. I don't even know what was in it. And I remember the advert on TV was you would press your finger into a loaf of Wonder Bread and then take your finger off and it would spring back because it perfectly retained its quality. And I mean, it was just evil looking. Like this thing to me just toxic. It was so pure white. There was nothing real about it. But at that time, you know, brown bread was what kind of weirdo vegetarians would eat. Like, you had to be strange to want to eat. Now, of course, everyone eats brown bread, whole wheat bread, blah, blah, blah. You'd hardly get white bread anymore. So, I mean, that change will happen, and it is happening, and we're seeing it here as well. People are now starting to think about switching to in their diet to actually millet and whole grain. It's just much healthier than the super refined nuts. And that then creates the opportunities for the farmers, because now the farmers think, well, actually, millet is much more tolerant of, big climatic changes, seasonal variations, than maize is. And I'd rather grow millet because I'm more likely to get a crop. But the problem is, if I can't sell it, I don't want to grow it. So that's the change that has to happen. The demand is everything. Once the demand is there, then the farmers will absolutely adapt to that. But
I've
it's
come to the
really
party.
about demand.
Has the genetic diversity of those traditional field crops been preserved? Like, are there still little pockets of people maintaining them in places?
So we are I'm involved through my research organization, Bioinnovation Zimbabwe. I'm involved in seed exchanges between farmers for, traditional varieties of and land races of millet and sorghum and so on. Yeah, there is, I mean, there is a lot going on to preserve it, but that doesn't mean it's enough. Of course, and a lot more does need to be done. And I think that's going to happen. I think people are also, just from a food security point of view, I mean, it's like, this is actually a fundamental kind of human survival issue that we preserve these varieties for the future. So, yeah, I mean, I think it is happening, and what's happened so far has been unbelievably commendable when you look at the lack of resources that there are, and the fact that this is basically small-scale farmers just doing it amongst themselves. There's no Svalbard, seed vaults anywhere in Africa that are looking at these things. So it's in the hands of scale farmers, but it is happening. Yeah, for sure.
Are there other parts of the world that have similar conditions and stresses to Southern Africa that could be involved in broader scale exchanges of genetics? Or are you more focused on preserving on what's left in your area?
I must say, I'm very much focused on my area just because I just don't have the intellectual bandwidth to go beyond that. But of course, absolutely. I mean, the conditions that pertain in Southern Africa, well, it can pertain in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, are really similar to conditions in other parts of the world, in South America, of course, in Australia as well. And yeah, I mean, there's lots of similarities and lots of opportunities for exchange and building the Indian subcontinent as well, of course.
But well, one project that I'm working on is breeding tubalgia to be a better leaf vegetable.
Nice.
I'm in
Yeah,
talk.
well, don't get me started on leaf vegetables. We've got so many leaf vegetables in Africa that have, again, not really been looked at from a commercial point of view significantly, and they've all got to go. I mean, it's this these novel foods regulations are, I mean, essentially it's a trade barrier. Actually, it's actually a trade barrier, and it's cast in a different light, but in reality that's what it is. We had a small but very significant success in that we were able to convince the European food regulators that a traditional food, because the novel foods regulations were not set up to prevent the sale of traditional foods in the European Union. They were set up to prevent the sale of GM foods in the European Union without full toxicological safety assessments. And unfortunately, traditional food crops just got caught in the crossfire. And we then eventually managed to create a separate category for traditional foods and for GM foods, with a supposedly accelerated, simpler approval process for a traditional food. Well, they created the category, but I can't say it's been any simpler and any faster. So we're still battling with the European bureaucracy on that one.
Now,
which is,
another
yeah, pretty.
huge, sorry, another huge resource in your region are medicinal plants. So rooibos is an example of a Southern African plant that people have probably seen the tea, that beautiful dark red rooibos tea that's been commercialized and shared with the world. Do you have favorite medicinal plants that you think have further potential to be developed and shared more widely?
My journey with medicinal plants in Africa started when I was a student. I went from Zimbabwe to the US to do a master's, a long time ago, nearly 30 years ago. And I did a course on the first course I did on ethnobotany with a prominent ethnobotanist from the New York Botanical Garden called Michael Bayleck, very well known. And he gave this presentation about the plant origins of medicines, pharmaceuticals. And he listed something like, the 100 most widely used pharmaceutical products in the world that were plant derived. And he showed a map of the world and he put a dot on the map where each of these plants came from. And there was a whole load of them in Southeast Asia, China, India. There was a bunch of them in Europe and North America, and of course, quite a cluster around the Amazon and South America. And then right there in the middle of the map was this great big giant hole with Africa and like basically not a single one from Africa. And I just looked at that and I was offended. I was like, what? I mean, actually, as Homo sapiens, we started in Africa. We started in Africa. So we've been using medicinal plants in Africa longer than we've been using medicinal plants in any other part of the world. And yet, not one of the top 100 pharmaceutical products that are plant derived come from Africa. Why is that? Well, it's because we haven't done research. It's not because they're not there. It's because we haven't done the research. So to go back to the point I made earlier, if you want exciting opportunities, then African medicinal plants is absolutely right at the top because, boy, we've got them all, but they just haven't, the work just hasn't been done on them. And of course, the traditional use, I mean, go to any traditional healer in Africa, and most people in Africa do go to traditional healers. Of course, all of their medicines are plant derived. Almost every single one is plant derived and usually in quite sophisticated combinations. And I mean, it's just a remarkable asset and potential. I mean, I could, yeah, there's so many medicinal plants I could talk about. But I mean, let me give you one that I've been working on that is really, really fascinating. We have a plant in Southern Africa. It's found in Zimbabwe, Namibia, a little bit in South Africa. And it grows on, it's a geophyte, it grows on bare rock. And it's called Myrothamnus flabellifolius. We call it the resurrection bush. And this is a plant that is specially adapted to these unique conditions of a rock. We've got a lot of, Zimbabwe's got a lot of bare granite kind of crops. I'm sorry, I can't remember what the current name for Ayers Rock is in
Oh,
Australia.
it's Uluru
But
now.
Uluru, there you go, that's right. So think of Uluru, but and that's sort of what it looks like. We've got a lot of those in Zimbabwe, and it's just bare granite. And then halfway up, you'll look at it, and then on this bare granite surface, and there's plants growing. And it's like, I mean, it's a vertical cliff with plants growing. How? So this plant is the resurrection bush, somehow has established its ecological niche. That it grows in cracks just where there's just enough soil or biological detritus gathers there for it to put down roots and grow. And then in the dry season, it's got no moisture whatsoever and it completely shrivels up and dies. And you look at this plant and it's just dead. And then it gets one drop of moisture and it comes back to life again. And a resurrection plant, if you cut a twig of it and you keep it for 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, and then you stick that, and it's totally shriveled up twig, and then you stick it in water, It will come back to life again. It will turn green overnight, and all the leaves will come out. And it's just, I mean, this thing is incredible. It's remarkable. What are the reasons for that? Well, there's a lot of phytochemical constituents in that plant that allow it to do this, and that's been the focus of some significant and actually groundbreaking research in terms of potential application for drought-tolerant food crops. But this plant has a huge range of traditional medicinal uses. It's consumed as a herbal tea. It's also consumed in many different other ways. A common application is burning it and inhaling the smoke, which obviously is essentially producing some of the volatiles that come from it that are then absorbed. And yeah, I mean, it's a remarkable, remarkable plant, which no one has yet managed to cultivate. But again, we're still trying to work on creating the demand for it. But we're mostly focusing at the moment. So pharmaceutical regulation obviously is very high. To get a plant through a set of clinical trials costs a lot of money. So we are currently working on it for cosmetics, because for cosmetics, the bar is much lower. And you can create significant volumes of demand. So at today, the very day that we're recording this, my company that I work with in the UK is showing resurrection extract at a cosmetics trade show called SCS Formulate in the UK, showing it for the first time to the cosmetics industry. So we're very excited about the potential for it. And yeah, I mean, I always start with cosmetics over pharmaceuticals because of the lower regulatory hurdles. But if it's a cosmetically active, or if it's pharmaceutically active, there are often some cosmetic applications as well, or some what they call cosmeceutical, which is where bridges pharmaceutical.
And I think you mentioned when we were chatting before that there's other aloe species, so that are used medicinally in your part of the world. Many people are familiar with aloe vera, which I think has a very distant hybrid origin that no one's quite sure where it came from, but it's been circulating around like Arabia for many thousands of years, but it looks like its wild ancestors were hybridized and domesticated in that process. And this is just my bugbear. I'm so enthusiastic about this potential, but you've got so many just existing species that are on your doorstep that can have all of these different uses. So do you want to tell us a bit about the aloe genus in your part of the world? I think most people don't realize the huge mountain of diversity that's there.
Yeah, I mean, Southern Africa, and particularly South Africa, very, very well known for aloes and the very many different aloe species that are found. In South Africa, there's one that has been commercially used for quite a long time. It's an endemic to South Africa. It's called Aloe ferox, and Aloe ferox has been harvested, particularly in the sort of eastern coastal areas of South Africa, and used in skincare. It's also traditionally used as a medicinal.
The spines on those leaves. I used to grow aloe ferox when I was a succulent collector, and wow, it's a prickly customer.
Something else, huh? It's a really interesting plant. It's a really interesting plant. So in Zimbabwe, we don't have Aloe ferox. Aloe ferox is, as I said, it's endemic to South Africa. South Africa has this extraordinarily high levels of plant endemism, because the Cape Floral Kingdom, or the with the often referred to as fynbos, is unique. It's not found anywhere else. So I don't remember the statistics, but something like 60% of the plants that are found in South Africa are only found in South Africa. Not as high as Madagascar, where I've just been, where something like 90% of plants that are found in Madagascar are endemic to Madagascar. But yeah, still, there's a lot of endemism in South Africa, and it's really interesting, particularly around, well, not particularly, but if you're a succulent enthusiast because of South Africa, the fact that a lot of South Africa really is dry, there are a lot of succulents there and a lot of endemic succulents. In Zimbabwe, we have an aloe called Excalsa. We have a lot of aloes in Zim, but we have an aloe called Excalsa, which is not just found in Zimbabwe. It's a central part of Southern Africa. It's quite widespread. And sometimes called the Zimbabwe tree aloe. It's got different names. But that has traditionally been used in herbal medicine for the treatment of diabetes and other metabolic diseases. It's also used for topical skincare, wound healing, etc. And it has been used in the cosmetics industry locally in skincare. And I think it has huge potential internationally as a crop. I first came across its commercial, well, I first came across its extraordinary healing properties when a friend of mine, she was a research ecologist, and she was driving herself up from the Zambezi Valley. The Zambezi Valley is at the bottom of a big escarpment. She was driving up the escarpment in her old Toyota Land Cruiser on her own. And halfway up, she noticed steam coming out of the radiator, and she stopped the car, and she didn't really know much about mechanics. So she took the top off the radiator, and all this steam jetted out onto her face. And she was basically scalded by this burning hot and was knocked out. She actually was lying there on the road, unconscious for a while from this. And there was nobody around. And then she came to, and she was in screaming agony on her face. And she was lying on the side of the road. And she saw this aloe excelsa just right there. And she knew that you could use aloe for burns. So she crawled over to it, and she took some strips off the leaves, and she put them onto her face, just directly, just took strips off and put them directly onto her face. And eventually a car came past, and they picked her up, and they took her to hospital, like a 3-hour drive to get to the capital city and into hospital. And so it was several hours after she had burnt herself by the time she was finally in the hospital, and the surgeon came and peeled off this thing. And then they did whatever they did. And then when she finally came round the next day, the surgeon said, "Well, I don't know what that stuff was that you put on your face, but it saved your face. You probably would not have a face had you not done that." And she's, you wouldn't know. If you saw her now, you wouldn't know that anything had happened to her. I mean, it's utterly, utterly remarkable, this plant. And a friend of mine is a professor of chemistry at the University of Zimbabwe, and he was producing a face cream that used Kigelia africana. That's another medicinal plant. I'll talk about that just now. Kigelia africana and aloe excelsa. And this thing is just the most extraordinary product for burn treatment and sun damaged skin and all the rest of it. So, yeah, I mean, I think aloe excelsa is, it grows nicely, nice easily. I think it's got huge potential, huge potential. Of course, you're probably competing with aloe vera, which is grown on a very large industrial scale in parts of the southern USA and so on. But I mean, it's not the only. And I think the really interesting thing with aloe excelsa is the diabetes, actually, not just the skincare. We've got an explosion of metabolic diseases in Africa at the moment as we kind of progressively switch out the really healthy traditional foods for the much, much, much less healthy Western convenience foods. And the result is just, yeah, it's horrendous. So there's a real need for anything that can help with that. And aloe excelsa is a really obvious one. So
But for all the plant breeders in the audience, the breeding of medicinal plants is something that I think gets completely overlooked. And aloe is such a huge, diverse genus with all of these little ones that stick out for extraordinary medicinal properties. And they're pretty much all interfertile with each other. They're big, chunky, bird pollinated flowers. So if you can get them to flower and you can line up the crossing, and then you can have some method of assessing the medicinal properties of the hybrids, I think that's another huge area that nobody's thought to stumble into. And yeah, I'd encourage anyone out there in the audience who are curious about this, strongly consider breeding aloes for medicinal properties. So we should probably wrap things up because I know you've got other things on the go, and I don't want to take too much of your time. This has been amazing. I would love to pick your brain for hours. I would love to teleport to all of the places that you've been in Southern Africa, because it is a place that has always been close to my heart, even though I've never been there. But maybe one day I'll get on a plane and come over. But can you tell us where people can learn more about your work and follow up with all the amazing stuff that you do?
Yeah, sure. So I've got a YouTube channel called African Plant Hunter. I make educational videos about plants. I also make videos about places I've been to find the plants, sort of more general kind of travel style. But yeah, medicinal plants, food plants, so on. I'm also as African Plant Hunter on Facebook or Instagram. It's all the same stuff. I've got a website, africanplanthunter.com. You can also have a look at my nonprofit research organization, which is called BioInnovation Zimbabwe, and you'll find us at bio-innovation.org. And yeah, if you want to see the work I'm doing on Baobab, you can see it on the African Baobab Alliance. So it's just africanbaobaballiance.org. Oh
Excellent.
yeah,
Oh, yeah.
finally, finally, one final one, which is not I'm just a part of it, is an organization called Fair Wild. So just look up fairwild.org. This is a certification system around indigenous plants that are wild harvested just to guarantee their sustainability and the sustainability and the fair, equitable trading conditions from the communities involved in producing them and supplying them. So fairwild.org.
Amazing. I knew when I saw your YouTube channel that I had to talk to you, and I am so grateful that I got the opportunity. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been really enjoyable.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.